Good morning. I want to invite you to turn to the book of Exodus, chapter 6. Exodus chapter 6, we'll start in verse 5 here in a few minutes. I'm going to tell you a very disturbing piece of information here as we begin. This silver-colored device on my wrist is a gift from my wife on our wedding day, and today, the battery is dead on this watch. There is a clock in the back of the room. It's very difficult for me to see, so we'll just see what happens, all right? I do want to tell you that I like to tell stories. I like to talk about movies. I like to be witty. I like to have really inspirational things to say, but today, first thing that came to my mind is, today I'm not going to do any of that. Today, I don't have anything fancy to say. I just want us to listen and hear the Word of God, the story of His rescue of His people, and what it means for us here and now. We started last week and we talked about God's people, the people who bear God's promise, the people through whom God wants to restore and redeem the world. His very people have become enslaved in the land of Egypt. And where we left off last week is that the people making bricks day after day cried out in their oppression and their suffering, and God heard them. And that's very good news to anyone who finds themselves out of the depths of life and out of the struggle of the world in which we live. When we cry out, God hears us. That's good news. And today, where we pick up, the people are still in Egypt. God has heard their cry, but they're still making bricks. They make bricks day after day after day. I want you to imagine that you wake up in the morning, early, before the sun comes up, and you go outside and you report to an area of town, and you're given the materials, and you're told to make bricks. And as the sun comes up over the desert and gets hot and starts to burn your skin, you're told to make bricks. And as you get thirsty and hungry and long to take a break, you're told to make bricks. And as people around you fall down of heat exhaustion, and some of them maybe even die, you are told to make bricks. And as the day goes, and as dinner time comes and goes, and as the sun begins to go down, you're told to make bricks. More bricks. More bricks for Pharaoh, more bricks for the empire, more bricks to build the comfort of Egypt. And day after day, and then you go back to your home exhausted, worn out, beat down. You eat what you can find, and you collapse into bed. And you wake up the next morning only for it to start over again. And you're father and mother did the same thing and did it until the day that they died. And their parents did the same thing and did it until the day that they died. And their parents did it and did it until the day that they died. And their parents did it and did it until the day that they died. And over time, if that is the reality in which you live, you come to discover what every person that we have documented writings who have experienced any kind of slavery over the history of the world, they all say the same thing. And that is that their oppressors, their slave drivers, beat them and beat them until their identity is that they are a slave. And almost all slaves eventually acknowledge and come to the point where they too believe that that is their identity. Many of you may have read the book or seen the movie called 12 Years a Slave, which is a true story. It actually happens here in the state of Louisiana in the 1840s and 50s. It's about a man named Solomon Northup, who was a free black man in the North and was kidnapped and sold into slavery. And if you've seen the movie, there's a horrifying scene right towards the beginning as he finds himself in chains in a basement. And a man comes in, a slave trader comes in and tells him, "You are a slave." And Solomon says, "I am not a slave, I am a free man." And the slave driver picks up a piece of wood and beats him over the back, yelling, "You're a slave, you're a slave, you're a slave," until the piece of wood shatters into pieces. And then he picks up a whip and he starts whipping Solomon until over and over and over, yelling at him, "You're a slave, you're a slave, you're a slave." Until finally Solomon learns that although he knows deep down somewhere in his heart that he is a free man, he learns to never ever believe or speak those words again for many, many years. And we come to the story of the Israelites in slavery, and day after day they build bricks for generation after generation. This is their reality, their identity. They may even have come to believe that they deserve this. It's their story day after day. But this story has within it a great disruption. A great disruption to the story of bricks day after day after day. Because this is not the story that God intended for his people to live. As we saw last week, God hears and raises up Moses. And Moses, if you read in Exodus chapter 3, knows that he's not good enough to do what God's asking him to do. God is asking him to go and be the instrument of God's liberation for his people, and Moses knows he's not good enough, he's not smart enough, and people don't like him. But God will use him. So let's look at Exodus chapter 6, what God says to Moses, starting in verse 5. "I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving. And I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord." So Moses, although he knows he is totally incapable of doing so, he goes, he meets up with his brother Aaron, who will be his mouthpiece, and they go to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, the head of the most powerful empire in the world. And he tells Pharaoh the message from God, "Let God's people go." And Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." So God decides to act decisively, to show that he will rescue his people, that powers of injustice will not be able to stand against his power. Let's look over in chapter 7 of Exodus, starting in verse 14. "Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is unyielding. He refuses to let the people go. So go to Pharaoh in the morning as he goes out to the water and wait on the bank of the Nile to meet him. And take in your hand the staff that was changed into a snake, and then say to Pharaoh, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me to say to you, let my people go so that they may worship me in the desert. But until now you have not listened. This is what the Lord says. By this you will know that I am the Lord. With the staff that is in my hand, I will strike the water of the Nile, and it will be changed into blood. The fish in the Nile will die, and the river will stink. The Egyptians will not be able to drink its water.' And down in verse 20, Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord had commanded. He raised his staff in the presence of Pharaoh and his officials and struck the water of the Nile, and all the water was changed into blood. The fish in the Nile died, and the river smelled so bad that the Egyptians could not drink its water. Blood was everywhere in Egypt. This is the first of what we know as the 10 plagues, 10 calamities that God brings on the land of Egypt. We'll list them. The first one is water to blood, then frogs, gnats. By the way, frogs. I have this frog sometimes that hops up on my back porch and starts squeaking and squawking right as it's time to go to bed. That one frog drives me insane. Sometimes I'll go out there in my sandals and I'll just be like, where's that frog? And I'm like, and sometimes I'm just going to admit some sin to you right now. Sometimes I scoop up that frog in a cup or in a bowl and I just toss it over the fence into the other person's yard. So there you go. I've confessed. That's probably not a neighborly thing to do. Jeff, Kristen, if you're listening, I'm really sorry. Frogs everywhere. The whole land is filled with them. And each time after God sends a plague, Pharaoh comes to Moses, or Moses comes to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, oh, this is terrible. Everybody's crying out. Will you just get rid of all these frogs for me? And Moses says, we'll get rid of the frogs. Let God's people go. And Pharaoh says, no. And so it starts all over again. Frogs, gnats, flies, death of the Egyptian livestock, boils, hail, locusts, darkness. And as we'll see in a few minutes, the death of the firstborn of all those in Egypt. What's really important for us to notice in this story is, as we read through a modern lens and we look back on this, this sounds like God is just like a petty child on a playground who somebody smacked his friend, and so he's going to smack that person back and throw rocks at him and then put their head down in the mud and say, you don't mess with my friend anymore. And we feel like this is spiteful. We look back on it and we say, why would God do these things? What did the Egyptians ever do to deserve all that? And here's the truth in all of that, is that Pharaoh and the people of Egypt have been part of living their lives in a way that is at the expense of other people. And when God brings these plagues on Egypt, he's not just trying to be spiteful and mean. He's trying to send a message that this is what God will do to protect the innocent. This is how strongly God feels about rescuing people who are beat down. And it's really interesting, if you look at all of these plagues, many of them have connection to the Egyptian gods. The people of Egypt had multiple gods that they worshipped, and one of the main gods that they worshipped was the Nile River. They worshipped the river as a god in their culture. It was the lifeblood, pun intended, of their culture. It irrigated their fields and provided for their crops. Egypt was known in the ancient world as the breadbasket of the ancient world. It was fertile. It grew lots of food, and it was productive because of this river, this powerful river flowing through it. And they worshipped the river as a god, as a great power in their culture that gave them life. And so it's no surprise that God begins his judgment on Egypt by striking at the very heart of not only their religious system, but their economic system. If you want to get a people's attention, you mess with their pocketbooks and their religion, and you'll pick a fight real fast. It's also interesting, several scholars pointed this out as I was reading this week, when Pharaoh decides that the people of Israel have become too numerous and he wants to get rid of some of the, and they kill every Israelite child under the age of two, every boy they kill, and then they throw them into the Nile River. And it's as if God is sending a message that I have not forgotten what has happened to those children. The frogs. The Egyptians worshipped a goddess called Heket. She was the goddess of fertility. And we say, okay, this is so backwards, these ancient people who worship these idols, what's up with that? But if you think about it, people in our culture, we worship productivity, don't we? We worship all the things that we want to come to pass and being able to get those things done and to accomplish those things. And so let's not be too quick to dismiss and judge those people in Egypt. They had a name, they had personified these gods. We just call them things in everyday life. And what's interesting is that the goddess, the fertility goddess Heket, her face in all of the ancient drawings and pictures of her, she's depicted, her head is depicted as the head of a frog. And so God sends frogs as a wink to Pharaoh and the people that your gods are nothing compared to the power of the one true God. The Egyptians had another god, Hathor. She was the mother goddess and the goddess of the sky, and she's portrayed as a cow, which I don't know why she deserved that, but when God strikes down the livestock of the Egyptians, that certainly would have been on their mind that this god is greater than Hathor, the mother goddess. And most of us are aware that the Egyptians worshiped the sun, who they called Ra. And they worshiped the coming and the going of the sun. They believed that Ra was the creator god, the firstborn. And they believed that Pharaoh himself was a descendant of Ra, that he somehow embodied the power of Ra in the flesh. And so when God brings darkness on the land of Egypt, it would have sent a message loud and clear that God, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, God of the Israelites, is more powerful than the gods of Egypt. Let's turn over to chapter 9, verse 13. It says this, then the Lord, verse 13 of chapter 9. Then the Lord said to Moses, get up early in the morning, confront Pharaoh and say to him, this is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews says, let my people go so that they may worship me. For this time I will send the full force of my plagues against you and against your officials and your people, so that you may know that there is no one like me in all the earth. For by now I could have stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with a plague that would have wiped you off the earth, but I have raised you up for this very purpose, that I might show you my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. It comes to this climax, to this turning point. And God keeps telling Pharaoh, let my people go. And Pharaoh, eager to hold on to his labor, to the comfort that it brings, says no. His heart becomes hard. And the turning point comes with this 10th plague. And in chapter 12, starting in verse 21, we'll be there in a moment. In chapter 12, verse 21, Moses goes to Pharaoh and tells Pharaoh, if you do not let God's people go, God will strike down all the firstborn in Egypt. And he tells the people of Israel, he gives them instructions as we'll read here. Then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, go at once. Select the animals for your families and slaughter a Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it into the blood of the lamb and in the basin and put some of the blood on the top and on both sides of the door frame. None of you shall go out of the door of your house until morning. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the top and sides of the door frame and he will pass over the doorway and he will not permit the destroyer to enter your houses and strike you down. Down in verse 28, the Israelites did just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "Up, leave my people, you and the Israelites, go. Worship the Lord as you have requested. Take your flocks and herds as you have said, and go. And also, bless me." God brings the empire of Egypt to its knees. If it wasn't obvious before this, God takes seriously the cries and suffering of those who are weak and oppressed in the world. And I believe that we still serve that God today. He hears those who cry out. He hears those who are struck down, those who are held under the water, those who feel like they are suffocating and cannot breathe. God hears their cry, and God is at work. Maybe not in the ways that we see in this story, maybe not in ways that are so completely obvious as they are in this story, but God is at work, and God will act, and he will come to the aid of those who are oppressed. Pharaoh lets the people go, and the people of Israel leave Egypt, and it says that they march out of Egypt. And from what we can tell, what we know from the story and from what we can tell from other writings from the period, it seems like that it's probably almost 2 million people that leave the land of Egypt and they walk out toward a new life. But as is often the case for those who are in power, those who find their comfort and their way of life supported by holding others down, Pharaoh changes his mind. After all that's happened, after all that God has done to show his mighty hand, Pharaoh changes his mind and he assembles his army and they march out after the Israelites. And so let's go to chapter 14. And we're going to read most of this chapter, chapter 14, starting in verse 5. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea." That's in verse 1. Let's go down to verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, "What have we done? We have let the Israelites go and we've lost their services." So he had his chariot made ready and he took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites, who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hahiroth, opposite of Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us out here to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out here out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone and let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch it out. Stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." Then the angel of the Lord, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front of them and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to one side and light to the other side, so that neither went near the other all night long. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And all that night, the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He made the wheels of the chariots come off so that they had difficulty driving. And the Egyptians said, "Let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen." Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak the sea went back into its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen. The entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea, not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. That day the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord had displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. God rescues. And if you want to see a party like none other, read on into chapter 15 if you have time later today, where the people cry out, "The Lord has thrown horse and rider into the sea. The Lord has bared his mighty arm against the Egyptians. He has set us free. Great is the Lord." We live in a world that's broken and fragmented, a world where we find ourselves enslaved to the way things are. And it's not just that God rescues the Israelites from the people of Egypt. God is a God who wants to rescue all people, in all times, in all places. God is a God who rescues, and we all need to be rescued. I want us to notice three things today, three things about this story. Sometimes, like Israel, I need to be rescued because I'm enslaved. I'm enslaved to sin, darkness, or I'm enslaved to living out a story that sometimes doesn't lead to life. And I don't mean to say that in a way that invalidates the very real suffering and slavery of people that have endured much harsher things in life than I could ever imagine. But every single one of us on some level knows what it's like to be stuck, to be trapped, to be enslaved. And so maybe to you today, you hear this story and you hear these words of hope that God comes to the aid of those who are enslaved. And whatever it is in your life that is holding you back, that is holding you down, God wants to help you carry that. And he wants to show you a better life. Sometimes, this is the second way to see and hear this story. Sometimes, like Pharaoh, I need to be rescued from the ways in which my way of life deprives others of life. And other times, like Moses, I need to be rescued from being disempowered, and I need to join God in what God is doing to bring about the liberation of others. When God rescues, it almost always involves three elements, all related to power. God empowers those who have been oppressed and have had their dignity robbed, and he invites all people to not be held down by their circumstances, but to know that their true identity in God is beloved children. The second way that this story is related to power, God opposes the power of the strong, or takes that power away, or confronts that power, showing it to be inferior to his own power and contrary to his good purposes for the world. And thirdly, God rarely acts alone. He empowers partners to join him in the liberation of others, people who will represent him to the powers as agents of his rescue. God is a rescuing God. He rescues individuals, he rescues whole groups of people, and he wants to rescue the whole world. And we are called, as broken people, we are called to hear God's rescuing call, to leave Egypt behind, and to follow his voice toward a new story. Some of us need a new story. The story that we've been living isn't working for us. It's not working for the people around us. It's not a good story. Any story that's not the story that God invites us to is a story that doesn't really matter. And I don't know about you, but I've been guilty so much of my life in pursuing stories that don't matter. Stories of affirmation from other people. Stories of success. Stories of pride. Stories of greed. Stories of wanting to be right and not trusting in God. Stories that are all about me at the expense of other people. And God invites me to leave those stories behind and to walk through the sea and to die to myself and to walk out the other side a new person. And as that happens, we bear the responsibility to discover the ways in which we have been part of the power of Egypt. How have I created hurt by the ways that I've lived? Do my convictions and my desires and my values and my comfort contribute to a system that directly or indirectly holds other people down or shuts them out? And where do I see people who are trampled, who are abused, who are being robbed of their dignity as human beings made in the image of God? And how can I join God in what he's doing and what he wants to do to liberate, to rescue, and redeem? There's two possible stories. There's the story of Egypt, and there's the story of God. And we have a choice. We can choose. The people of Israel, as they stand by the sea with the sea on one side and Pharaoh's army coming upon them on the other side, many of them say, we should have stayed in Egypt. And anyone who has ever started down the road, the journey to change, will tell you that they have come to a point where they said, I don't know that this is worth it. At least back in Egypt, I knew what the expectations were. I knew what the rules were. Just take me back to Egypt. It's what I know. It's what I'm used to. And we have a choice to stay in Egypt or to pursue God's story, God's adventure. I was reading this week the story of a Japanese soldier in World War II named Hirohito Onoda. He was on an island in the Pacific, and that island was overrun, was taken by the Allies. And Japanese soldiers had sworn an oath to their nation and to their emperor to fight to the death, to never, ever surrender for any reason. And it was a great shame to be taken captive, to be imprisoned or taken alive, and so many soldiers would fight down to the last man. Japanese pilots would fly their airplanes, even after they had run out of ammunition, they would fly their fighters into boats or into other planes or into barracks at airfields. Hirohito Onoda was a soldier whose army had lost the battle for their island, and he and a few others fled into the forest, vowing to continue the fight. That was in February 1945. And in 1974, someone found Hirohito Onoda in the jungle, still with his uniform on, still ready to fight the Allies. For 29 years, he had lived in the jungle, unaware that the war had ended, that Japan had lost the war, and that Japan and the United States were now allies and were working together in the world. He had no idea. He was living out a story for 29 years, not knowing that the battle had already been decided. And he lived on that island in that jungle, living out the wrong story. And I look at myself and I think, that's me. God has already won the war. He's already fought the battle. He's invited me to walk with him toward new life. And I find myself holed up in my treehouse fort in the jungle, in my little kingdom, holding on to dear life for the story that I've written for myself, refusing to let go and believe that there's a different story out there to be lived. The rescue is already underway. The war has already been won. Let's make sure that we're not stuck in Egypt living out the old, tired, defeated stories. The stories of selfishness, the story of nationalism, the story of my way. When we've been invited and called to live out a new story, a rescue story, the Exodus story. The Egypt story keeps us where we are, enslaved in all kinds of ways, taking advantage of others, sitting on the sidelines when it comes to the suffering of the world. And the God story invites us into the great unknown to get up, to walk out of Egypt, and to walk into the water, and to let our old selves be washed away, and to walk out the other side, changed. Not as an end to the story, but as the beginning. That's the invitation for each of us today. As I've already said, you might resonate today with the story of Israel, and you are enslaved to something in your life, and you need to be rescued, and you don't know how to do that. You feel like the power of Egypt, the power of addiction, the power that's enslaving your life, the despair and the frustration that you cannot do it on your own, and all you can do, as we said last week, is cry out to God, and God says, I have sent a deliverer to you. Come and get up and walk out of Egypt, and walk through the sea, through the waters, and let me put to death the life of living a slave in you and become a free person. Maybe like me, oftentimes in my life, you recognize that there are ways in which you're living things that you've done in the past and things that you're still doing that are hurtful to other people. And maybe what you need for God to do today is to drown the Egyptian in you. To leave that part of you that hurts other people and to leave that in the water and to come out the other side a new person. Maybe for you today, maybe you've been rescued, you've followed God's voice, you've put to death the old person, and now you're asking, God, what do you want me to do? What do you need for me to do? God, what do you want for my life? What are you calling me to do, to be? Who are you asking me to be? Where are you asking me to go? And God says, pick up a newspaper. Pull up the news. There are places all over the planet, and right here, even in our own neighborhood, where people are hurting and need God's rescue. And maybe like Moses, you say, God, I can't do that. I'm just me. I'm just a college student. I'm just a high school student. I'm just a stay-at-home mom. I'm just a guy who sits at a desk. I can't do that. And God says, who gives people their mouths? Is it not I, the Lord? Go, and I will do my work through you, a weak vessel. Whatever place you find yourself today, as Israel, as Egypt, or as a person waiting to be used, the invitation is to walk into the water, to let God lead the way forward, for you to listen to his voice and to walk out the other side changed and free and ready to follow God wherever the road leads. So that's the invitation. I want to invite us to stand. And then we're going to sing a song together. And as we've talked about several times in the last few weeks, sometimes this time sort of carries a stigma to it that only people whose lives are like totally falling apart need to respond during these times, and that's not the case at all. You might have something to rejoice in today. Like the Israelites in chapter 15 of Exodus, you might say, God has rescued me from the pit of slavery. God has brought me out of the despair, and this is what he's doing in my life, and I'm just so thankful, and I just wanted to share it with somebody. I want to invite you to share that with somebody. to find one of our elders or our ministers in the aisles, or to tell the person next to you. They might be singing and you might say, could you stop singing for a second? Because I just have to tell you what God has done in my life, the way that he's freed me. If you have any need at all, if you want prayer, if you need rescue, if you need someone to be Moses and to listen to the cry of your heart, then please come do that as we sing together. Let's sing.